You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Jen White wraps up a week-long series on water with the latest on how drought and new decisions on water policy affect America's farmers and the price we pay for our food. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, there have been a lot of shipwrecks in the course of human history, some famous, many more forgotten. The Lusitania during World War I played a part in world history. Here in the Midwest, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lives on in legend and song. But the Titanic looms large over the history of shipwrecks. In his new book, our next guest shares the story not just of the Titanic, but of the people who obsessed over it, quested to find its remains and to bring them up to the surface, in some cases even claimed to own the wreck. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an interest in shipwrecks? Are you curious about them? Have you seen one up close? Maybe we've got a few different museums around the Great Lakes that show remains of shipwrecks. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your own memories, your questions for our guests. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure and a senior editor for National Geographic. He's a former White House correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Will you start off with a little quiz you give people? I know the answer already. I cheated. I read the book. You ask people how many shipwrecks they think there are out there in the seas. And I think I can guarantee anybody who's coming up with a number is probably too low. Could you give us a sense of the scope of shipwrecks?
Yeah, I've asked this question to hundreds of people over the past few years, and everyone is wrong. When we think of how many shipwrecks there are in the world, we usually think of the big ones, the Titanic, the Lusitania, as you mentioned. But we forget that for centuries, this is how people transported themselves and goods all over the world. And so the number, according to UNESCO, about 10 years ago, is actually 3 million shipwrecks in the oceans, lakes, and rivers all over the world.
Now, the Titanic, as you mentioned, gets a lot of the attention. And it wasn't, you write, the biggest or the deadliest shipwreck of all time. So what is it about the wreck of the Titanic that made it such a big thing that we're still talking about it to this day?
Well, you're right. There's almost nothing unique about the Titanic. I mean, ships had been built big before. There were a lot of ships for rich people that ferried people across the Atlantic. Even iceberg strikes were very common in the 1880s and 90s. They had actually started to decline around the time of the Titanic. So I kind of narrowed down on this theory that the reason the Titanic has so much lasting staying cultural power is this weird quirk of a ratio of numbers. We all know that about 1,500 people died on the Titanic, but also about 700 people lived. And those 700 were mostly young women and children who ended up living another 50, 60, 70 years, telling and retelling the stories of that night. And storytelling is what keeps kind of the cultural lore of any event alive. And in that case, kept the Titanic alive enough to be reinvented in movies, books, and museum exhibits for more than a century.
Now, your book is not just about the Titanic, but about the people who've gotten obsessed with it over the years. Can we throw you in with that category? Was there something that just like got you so interested, obsessed with hearing these stories?
I have resisted being a shipwreck obsessive, but I think I am. I love these wrecks. There's so many around the world. I fixated on the Titanic since I was a boy, as most young people do. It's just a great story. I did my science project when I was in first grade on floating and sinking and figuring out why some things float and why they don't. I frankly still struggle to understand, you know, the viscosity of materials and how ships are built. It's an endless world of mystery and intrigue, especially when you get to old ships and wrecks carrying buried treasure and you know, races for lost shipwrecks. It really gets fascinating.
Talking to Daniel Stone, his new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in if you share his curiosity about the Titanic and other shipwrecks. If you have a question to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, of course, I'd heard about the Titanic. I didn't really know about this world of people who, over the years, tried to find it. And once it was found, tried to bring it up. You talked to some of the people. Give us a sense of the scope from the, like, amateurs and maybe weirdos, we might say, to the professionals and all points in between. There's a lot of people who have done this stuff.
Yeah, almost immediately after the Titanic sank, there was this effort to try to find it and salvage it, raise it up. And, you know, for people in the early 20th century who had no experience doing this, this didn't seem that outlandish, right? There was one guy named Charles Smith in 1914, 2 years after the Titanic sank, who said, I'm just going to go to the wreck site, or I'm going to go to the site where it went down. I'm going to drop a few electromagnets in the water. They're going to attract themselves to the ship. They're going to attach themselves, and then we'll just pull them up as though it would be that easy. And the 20th century is filled with people like Charles Smith who start to imagine this goal. They think it's fascinating. They think there's a lot of fame and fortune to be gained for whoever finds and raises the Titanic. And they keep getting defeated. They have these wild plans of, you know, finding the ship and putting ping pong balls in the ship or foam that'll float it to the surface. And they keep getting pushed back, mostly because they're amateurs. You know, ship salvage is a real industry, but for people who just love wrecks, they don't have the equipment, the knowledge, and the experience really to pull up a ship, let alone one as big as the Titanic, 2.5 miles deep.
Now, you had kind of an obsession trying to meet the man who owned the wreck of the Titanic, or at least told the world that he owned it. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, this is a funny story of the Titanic, and this man, his name's Doug Woolley, is the central character of my book, very colorful character, who basically decides as a young boy in the 1940s that he wants to own the Titanic that's underwater. And he goes through this elaborate legal process when he becomes a young man, and he puts ads in newspapers, and eventually he gets to a point where nobody objects. You know, the wreck is underwater. Nobody knows where it is. No one's going to fight him on it. And so he spends most of the 60s, 70s, and 1980s claiming that he owns the wreck. And he plans to go find it. He plans to corral a team together to go salvage it. And this is written up in newspapers all over the world, in every country, as this man who owns the wreck. And Doug Woolley is still alive. He's 86, lives in England. I went to visit him. He still thinks it's possible. And I kind of realized that this was the North Star of his life. And the Titanic was something he really wanted to go save. But at almost every point of his life, the Titanic kept reinventing Doug Woolley and saving his life instead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, this is a great topic. My 9-year-old son has been obsessed with the Titanic for at least 2 years. He has a poster and Legos with a really awesome Titanic ship. There's so many unbelievable stories about that tragedy. I don't know if they're actually true. Like, one was there was a, you know, sailor who was told at the last minute not to go, but he had the key to the room where the lookout people would have normally been able to see the iceberg with the binoculars, but the room was locked with the binoculars that they normally would have used. And that's why they didn't see it sooner. And my son has these I Survived book series about natural or historical tragedies that occur throughout the world. And this whole thing, he's been a huge history buff, but the Titanic really was the thing that jump-started his interest in history.
Interesting, Brian. A couple of things there, Daniel. First of all, that legend. There are lots of legends about the Titanic. You were just talking about Doug Woolley. He had a family legend that he had a couple of relatives who, at the last minute, had a premonition that something bad was going to happen, didn't get on the ship. I don't think that was confirmed. There's a lot of these stories out there.
Yeah, almost endless stories. I haven't heard that specific one about the binoculars. It sounds like something that would have happened aboard the Titanic. But to your caller's point, I mean, the amount of folklore and urban legends that sometimes are facts, sometimes not, but inspire this next generation. I mean, a 9-year-old today, was not even alive at the 100th anniversary of the Titanic and is still deeply inspired. That's beautiful and kind of speaks to his sense of history and putting himself in its place.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about shipwrecks? Why ships sink? What happens when they do? Are you personally curious, like our caller's kid was, about shipwrecks? Is there one that intrigues you in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone about his new book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in with your questions, your own shipwreck curiosities, Titanic or otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I was intrigued many years ago after reading a book about the fact that gold heavily laden on ships was, of course, very highly prized, and there wasn't really a good way to get it from California during the gold rush to the New York banks. The only way that it could be shipped was to go around the tip of South America and then up all the way up the coastline, all the way to New York. And that the building of the Panama Canal was really because of the ease of transportation of gold. And I thought you would be interested in that because so many ships laden heavily with gold have been found all along the South American coastline on the east and west sides, and, of course, along the whole eastern seaboard. The building of the Panama Canal was so important for the transportation of gold.
Interesting. Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. And then you reference there's a lot of gold, or has been over the years, from not just the California gold rush, but from the Spanish galleons taking gold across one ocean or another.
Yeah, especially, Rob, down by the coast of Florida is often called the Treasure Coast, from those specific two eras, the gold rush and one very large wreck that sank there in 1857 called the SS Central America, often called the Ship of Gold. And then all of the Spanish ships that were in Central and South America during the period of colonization, you know, getting and pilfering as much as they could, and they'd bring that treasure up along the coast of Florida and often get caught in storms. And so one of the most valuable shipwrecks ever found, the Nuestra Señora de Atocha, went down right around Florida. It was found in the 1970s with several hundred million dollars of gold on board. And it's believed there's many galleons still out there, many in those waters.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Cody joins us now in Chautauqua. Cody, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Cody?
So I was just curious, when it comes to shipwrecks, when a ship goes down, is it like a free-for-all for whoever wants to go explore it can go down there and maybe grab stuff or see what's going on with it? Or are there laws that prohibit people from going there and like disrupting it from where its resting place is? Because not only with the Titanic, but another one that I'm familiar with and I follow a lot with the history of is the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I was just curious as is to if people are not allowed to bother with it where it sits at the bottom of the lake or the ocean floor.
Cody, thanks a lot for that call. You wrote something to the effect of, Dan, the most important piece of technology for somebody looking for shipwrecks is a really good legal team.
Exactly. And this is a great question from Cody that has a kind of a long answer. I'll give a short one, which is ships are subject to very weird legal parameters, right? Ships can be built in one country, sail to another country, be carrying goods from a third country, holding people of different citizenships and nationalities. So the jurisdiction over a ship when it goes down can get very complicated very quickly. The Edmund Fitzgerald, on account of being fairly contained within the U.S. In the Great Lakes, is kind of a no-brainer and very easy. But when a ship like the Titanic goes down, or another one that's holding gold, you know, in the middle of the ocean, you often see these these big races among countries to prove that they had claim over the ship and the contents of it. But often these things get very legally thorny, and the best way to go for a ship is to choose one that's old, because when it's old, the insurers, the owners, the passengers, the families, everyone has mostly died. And those are the ships that are most often given or granted to the people who find them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Stone, author of the new book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Margaret joins us now in Franklin. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Margaret?
Well, it's such a wonderful show. I'm so excited because my grandson has been so interested in the Titanic, and just as the previous gentleman called and said his son was, he's been reading all the I Survived books, and I don't know where he got the interest from, but he is going on vacation with his family down to Tennessee, and from what they're telling me, there is a museum down there regarding the sinking and everything about the Titanic. So that sounded really interesting. He has to go see it. And I read a book some years ago called The Christmas Tree Ship, about the ship that used to haul Christmas trees from up north, Lake Michigan shore, down to Chicago in the 1800s. So people down there could have Christmas trees, live Christmas trees. And it sunk off of two rivers.
Yeah. Margaret, thanks for the call. We've talked about the Christmas tree ship on the show in the past. She mentioned that museum in Tennessee. A few different places have built, mostly on dry land, replicas of some or all of the Titanic, Dan.
Yeah, in Tennessee, actually in Pigeon Forge, there is a half-scale replica of the half of the Titanic, which is great to visit, especially for young people to see the ship up close. There's also one in Branson, Missouri. The first full-scale replica of the full Titanic is currently being built in a province in western China at the moment. One thing I learned while reading and learning about the Titanic is that the Titanic story is especially big in China for reasons I still don't know. But the movies, all of the James Cameron movie and many of the movies that have been made about the Titanic do especially well in China. And they love this story there and can't get enough.
Thanks for the call, Margaret. PJ joins us now in Appleton. PJ, hi.
Hi. Back in the 70s, when I was in high school, my brother was fireman, oiler, water tender, shipping out of the Merchant Marine and to Russia, a lot of different places. But at one point, he was shipping out on ore boats in the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at that same time, they came out with that song that you've mentioned the boat and the ship and the song. And my mama couldn't listen to it. We'd have to turn the radio off when that one came on.
PJ, thanks so much for sharing that. And that brings me to something I wanted to bring up, Dan, that I took away from your book. You know, nowadays we might go on a cruise on a ship for fun. Our biggest worry might be our blood sugar from the sweet drinks on it or whatever. Through most of history, up to pretty recently, going to sea is really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this was a extremely deadly way to travel, and really the only way to travel to another country for almost all of human history. And we have stories of people who made it across oceans, right, like Columbus or Da Gama, but we forget the many, many millions of people who died on ships. And so it's only recently, and it's kind of a sign of the technology of our modern era, that when we think of relaxing or having a vacation, we think of going on large boats, in some cases through the same waters where some of the biggest shipwreck accidents have been through history. And we don't really think much of it. And I will say that that's, you know, kind of a triumph of technology. And it's also, it doesn't happen very often that we see these accidents anymore. We still have accidents of cruise ships and container ships much less often and much less deadly.
Now, here's you also look into the sort of the physics and mechanics of a shipwreck. And here's something that struck me, right? I think of a ship like the Titanic slowly settling down to the ocean floor. Wrong. Like 30 mile per hour impact. Did I read that right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Titanic split in half on the surface, and the bow fell a lot faster, almost like a missile, 30 miles an hour. scientists have figured this out by looking at the current wreck site and reverse engineering how everything got where it was. But yeah, once a ship, which is of course lighter than the water it displaces, that's what helps it float. Once it takes on water, it becomes heavier, and it can become a lot heavier than the water. And when it has a trajectory of 2 miles or more, like the Titanic, to sink, its terminal velocity could be as high as 30 or even more miles per hour.
All right, I got to ask, after spending years pursuing the stories of shipwrecks, are you more or less likely to want to spend time on a boat at sea?
Oh, I get horribly, horribly seasick. I can't even be on a kayak or canoe. And one of my great fears of writing this book is, you know, to become a shipwreck expert and invited on cruises to talk about it and just, you know, reveal my extreme antipathy to ships. I love ships. I just can't handle being on them.
No offense. If I operate a cruise ship line, I'm probably not going to invite the shipwreck author.
There you go. Exactly.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Daniel Stone, author on science and adventure, senior editor for National Geographic. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic, about mainly the Titanic and the people who looked to find its remains over the years, bring them up. A lot of human stories involved in that. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Zucchini is in the garden and at the farmer's market, and it's on the menu. We'll have recipes and advice. As always, I'll probably talk about the zucchini relish recipe I found online. Perfect for those really baseball bat-sized zucchinis that sometimes just grow out of control in one's garden. Maybe that's just me. I don't know. And what does it mean to be Midwestern? A new survey tried to get to the bottom of that question. And we will, too, with Charlie Behrens from Manitowoc Minute. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Attorney General Merrick Garland made his first comments today after the FBI search of former President Donald Trump's home and estate in Florida. We'll break down the latest and talk about the big questions that are still unanswered. First, a new report from the CDC finds higher rates of certain medical conditions among young people who have had COVID-19. Research found some serious conditions like myocarditis to be more common, also found higher rates of symptoms associated with long COVID among children who had tested positive for the disease. Many of those conditions are still uncommon, though, even for kids who have had COVID. The news comes as parents and caregivers prepare to send kids back to school. CDC out with some new school guidelines today. Thought it'd be a good time to check in about what we know about COVID-19 and younger people in the back-to-school season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a parent, is COVID on your mind as school gets ready to reopen? If you work in a school, what kind of preparations are there, aren't there? What kind of changes are you expecting to see from last year? Are you worried? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. James Conway is a pediatric infectious disease specialist with the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Conway, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this report out from the CDC looking at the longer-term health impacts of COVID-19 on kids. There's a lot in there. What are some of the key findings that you saw there?
Yeah, it was a really interesting way of looking at this. And they basically took kids that had had contact with the medical system for COVID or those who had never had any evidence of COVID over a 2-year period. And what they did was basically just compare a whole bunch of different disorders that might have been diagnosed. And what we found was that you had about twice the risk of having clotting episodes that would lead to things like pulmonary embolisms or venous thromboembolic events, so basically sort of deep vein thromboses and things like that. But your risk was about doubled if you were a kid that got COVID compared to one that didn't get COVID. And then, as you mentioned, you know, this myocarditis, cardiomyopathy thing, also about double the risk. But lots of other stuff in there as well, certainly smell and taste disturbances, similar to what the adults have. The interesting part also was what wasn't there, and that COVID kids don't seem to have quite as much in the long COVID neurologic symptoms, nor do they have the long-term lung problems. So very different from what we see in a lot of the adults. And I think we're learning a lot continuing as we go forward to realize the kids and adults with COVID actually are really very different.
Now, I don't want to panic people out here. We say these rates of some of these conditions are doubled. That's going from really, really rare to just kind of rare. Is that about the right perspective there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, kids are pretty healthy and overall do pretty well with most of the things that that we're talking about here. However, you know, one of the things we need to be cautious about is that this may actually be an underestimate. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because these are kids that were the comparison group who had had some kind of contact with the medical system. And so the presumption is that they may have actually had illnesses that kind of brought them in. So it's a little bit of an imperfect way of doing this because, you know, to ideally do this correctly, you would have compared kids with COVID versus everybody that didn't have COVID, not just the ones that didn't have COVID, but also had contact with the medical system. So some people are actually saying that this may slightly underestimate, but either way, you know, I think in general, these things are relatively rare, but still doubling your risk of something, you know, especially as severe as having a blood clot or a pulmonary embolus is certainly something to take seriously.
I want to key in on myocarditis for a moment, because that's a symptom, a sign that was an extremely rare outcome of a COVID vaccine. I think some of the early findings were. But it sounds like, if I'm reading the numbers right, and please correct me if I'm wrong, actually having COVID is a much greater risk for myocarditis than the really, really rare risk from the vaccine.
Yeah, that's been true all along. And you're right. You know, this has been a concern that people have expressed, that there is a rare but, you know, certainly reportable issue with myocarditis, especially in healthy teenagers that get their vaccines very close together. You know, the risk of getting myocarditis from the infection itself, from the COVID virus itself, depending on the age group, is somewhere between 20 and 60 times higher risk than it is from the vaccine. And this new study basically highlighted that as we know now with COVID, it really does cause a lot of inflammation all throughout the body. And in particular, in the heart and the blood vessels are really the two areas that it seems to be very unique.
And Dr. Conway, there are a lot of, I think, open question marks about the long-term impacts of COVID for grown-ups and for kids. What kind of research would you hope to see in addition to this kind of innovative way, as you mentioned, of doing it? What are you hoping to see to learn more about longer-term COVID impacts for kids?
Yeah, it's really tricky and it's hard to do. You know, I think there's a lot of attention at this about this at the federal level in trying to establish sort of long-term funding to follow people with COVID who have residual symptoms. You know, we're hoping that there's going to be more of this kind of work also in kids. What really needs to be done, I think, is comparing how this looks for people that are vaccinated and get COVID versus people that are unvaccinated and get COVID. That's, I think, really going to be one of the key pieces of this. But it's pretty clear that adults get a very different version of longer COVID. They get a lot more neurologic stuff. They have a lot more long-term lung disorders. Kids do seem to be a little bit more spared from large numbers of them, at least having long-term problems. But when they do, they certainly are significant. You know, the other things in here was this issue of kidney failure. And one of the ones that we saw early in the pandemic that seems to have held up, which was an increased risk of developing diabetes after getting a COVID infection. So, you know, while they're all rare, you certainly want to do everything you can to protect the kids from getting any of these things.
Talking to Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at COVID-19 and kids as we head to the back to school season. Do you have worries on your mind, questions, hopes for this new school year? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a kid, a parent thereof, a teacher or other school worker, do you have questions for our guest? What is the school year? What do you know about precautions or changes coming into the fall? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, when it comes to getting ready for the new school year, I saw kind of a Q&A with a bunch of different vaccine experts, disease experts, things like that. The most consistent answer so many of them gave for concerned parents was, get your kid vaccinated. Is that still a solid advice?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, why not? You know, the safety is clear that these vaccines are extraordinarily safe. They certainly work well. They're not perfect. But, you know, what we're really trying to do is prevent severe disease, prevent these kinds of outcomes, but also keep schools open and keep kids in school. And so as much as we can to keep them healthy from all sorts of different diseases, it's really important to do that. But the more people that get vaccinated, the less likelihood there are going to be widespread outbreaks, because those are what potentially leads to the need to close schools and things like that. So without any question, vaccines are still our our best way of managing this going forward.
Now, the CDC is out with new guidelines. These just came out earlier today for schools. It gets pretty fine-toothed here. What are some of the key things that people who run schools should be thinking about when it comes to COVID safety in this school year?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still going through these because you're right. They just popped into all of our inbox earlier today. But basically what they're doing is lifting this whole idea of quarantine, which is that after you've been exposed to somebody with COVID that you need to confine yourself. They're really allowing people after they've been exposed to continue to go about their business. You know, certainly if they get symptoms, then they go into isolation for 5 days and then can come out of isolation, but still wearing a mask for the other 5 days. But the big change is really that they're going to stop asking people to remove themselves from society after they've been exposed. And I think it makes sense that, you know, we know that there's a lot of home testing going on. These things don't get reported. And to be honest, people are busy and can't really restrict themselves that much. People have missed so much school and work already. So it's really giving permission to people, for people to do what they've already kind of been doing, which is to, you know, monitor yourself, especially after you're getting exposed. If you get any symptoms, we all owe it to each other to take the responsibility to pull ourselves away. But just an exposure doesn't get you into quarantine. And so schools, at least, I think it'll make it a little bit easier for them to keep functioning. The kids with symptoms, the kids that test positive, stay home. But just because somebody in a classroom gets exposed doesn't mean that they have to also stay out. And I think that's going to be really helpful, especially with the young kids in the daycares.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Minocqua. Mike, hello.
Hi. I was just wondering if we understand any better what contribution kids make, especially as they go back to school and mix with one another, to community spread of COVID. Do we understand
that? Great question.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Really great question. And this is something that's really being investigated extensively. There's some recent data that actually just came out in the last couple of weeks that seems to suggest that kids don't seem to shed quite as much virus as adults, and that they seem to have a little bit better ability to handle the mucosal part of this. In other words, as you get the virus and it lands on the surface of your nose and throat, it starts replicating. But kids seem to be very, very rigorous in far as how they respond, and they develop a much quicker immune response. They don't seem to shed nearly as much as adults do in some of these small studies. And so I think that while we're always worried about them being able to introduce it, especially to vulnerable members of the population, they don't seem to be quite as much of a driver of the bigger outbreaks happening as adults do. I think the other is that, you know, we've always known for a lot of diseases that kids just don't cough and sneeze quite hard enough to aerosolize things. We know the kids under the age of five very rarely spread tuberculosis, for instance, to other people. So once you get to about age five or six is when you actually can cough and sneeze hard enough to really aerosolize these things. So, you know, they're certainly not unrelated to the ongoing outbreaks, but they don't seem to be as much of a driver as the adults are in a lot of these outbreaks.
Mike, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist with UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about new research about the health impacts on kids who have had COVID-19 and what you need to know about COVID-19 risks ahead of back to school over the course of the next few weeks. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about COVID-19 and the back-to-school season? Is there a concern you have, a nagging question, whether you're a student, a parent, or a teacher? What is your school going to look like this fall? Is it different than when the school year ended last year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about COVID-19 and children as parents and caregivers get ready to send kids back to school. Dr. James Conway with UW-Madison stays with us, pediatric infectious disease specialist, and you can join in. If you have questions at 800-642-1234, back to school concerns, whether you're a student yourself, a parent, or a teacher, 800-642-1234 is the number to call or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hi. I have my concern, of course, and this getting this news out. Everybody's talking about the confusion, even the medical. We don't know why kids are getting type 1 diabetes and on and on. I'm a type 1 diabetic. I was diagnosed at a young age because my immune system was heightened, you know, fighting off flu virus or whatever. So it's simple to me that the fact is kids are very susceptible. Parents need to be aware of this. Whether or not your child got COVID or not, the immune system is becoming aggressive, and that's when it can go after the cells in the pancreas causing type 1 diabetes. And I just want to mention that and get a comment. My niece is 3 years old, got COVID, and I told my brothers, pay attention because the immune system is heightened.
I gotcha. So, Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Conway, I've heard some preliminary research into the relationship between COVID and both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, if I'm not mistaken. What do we know so far?
Yeah, Bill's onto something here. You know, that we know that for a lot of these disorders that it's what we call two hits, where there's a genetic predisposition to something and then something else hits that kid and turns on their immune system and it kind of pushes them over the brink. And so type 1 diabetes seems to be in that category. There are also though people who don't seem to have a predisposition, you know, they don't have a family history and their immune system can just get really turned on by almost anything. And he's right, influenza and many other viruses can do it as well. And so we see that after certain outbreaks of viral diseases, that there are increased rates of all sorts of diseases where the immune system does get a little bit overzealous and starts attacking things. And in fact, you know, in addition to type 1 diabetes in this study, a lot of these clotting and other cardiac things are basically very similar, where, you know, a lot of things can turn on the immune system and cause it to actually start to cause increased clotting and then side effects from that as you kind of clot off blood vessels that feed important organs. So more and more study going into that, but he's right, it's kind of nonspecific. And so that's one of the reasons everything you can do to protect kids against viral illnesses is important. And that's why getting back to school is a good time to think about this, because lots of kids are behind on lots of different vaccines that protect them against all sorts of different disorders.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, can you talk us through the current vaccine guidelines for kids, school age and below? It can be easy to lose track of how many shots they're supposed to get when.
Yeah, good question, Rob. I'll try to keep it as simple as possible. So, you know, basically everybody obviously is supposed to have had a primary series of vaccines, which for most people is two doses of a Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. For immune compromised people, they get a third dose as their primary series. Then for everybody over age 50 or everybody who's got an immune compromising condition over age 12, those people should actually have now had two boosters since their original primary series. Everybody else who's healthy over age 5 should have had one booster by now. So again, everybody should have a primary series. Healthy kids over age 5 then should also have a single booster already. And then for a select group of people in the over age 50 group and people that have underlying immune compromising conditions, they should actually have gotten their second booster by now. And unfortunately, you know, we saw data come out from the Kaiser Family Foundation last week that about 70% of Americans are actually not up to date if you include this booster stuff in the schedule that they really should have gotten. So while you'll see on a lot of websites, you know, people proudly saying that 90% of Americans over age 65 have had their vaccines or 65% of the general population in Wisconsin, that's sort of a false narrative because that's only that primary series. And really everybody should have gotten at least one booster and a whole bunch of people should have gotten a second one by now.
Talking to Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest news about COVID-19 and kids as we head into back-to-school season. Still time for your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, you alluded to other vaccinations. I've seen concerns that for one reason or another, kids aren't getting some of those, you know, standard vaccinations and in high enough numbers, maybe because COVID cut off their access to healthcare one way or another, maybe because of wider vaccine skepticism. What are you seeing? What kind of concerns do you have?
Yeah, this is really a global phenomenon where we're seeing kids across the globe over these last couple of years have really missed out on opportunities to be vaccinated. And then even you know, as you start to emerge into a more normal activities, it, you know, it's really hard to get appointments now because people are just trying to catch up with all sorts of medical disorders that need to be evaluated and seen. And so, you know, people have really gotten backed up. In some areas, we're seeing as many as 30% of the kids are now behind, you know, and these are families that had really been dedicated to keeping their kids vaccinated. It just wasn't easy to do it. So the concern is that we're starting to see an emergence of diseases that we previously had under control. There's measles outbreaks in a couple different countries in Africa. We've started to see emergence of measles getting into Europe now. There's polio, as people have seen, just popped up in New York and in London. So this is kind of a global phenomenon. And so as people are now in August and getting towards back to school, really important to check in and make sure that not only the things you need right away, but also making sure that there aren't other things that need to be scheduled to be completely caught up over the next couple months.
I should ask, people maybe wondering, what about masks in schools? What are your thoughts on when, if, and where people should be wearing masks in school buildings?
Yeah, it's still pretty controversial. I mean, I think that they're certainly valuable when there's respiratory illnesses around. I mean, obviously, we've kept them in the medical system consistently and probably will indefinitely because, you know, these viruses actually circulate all year around. And there's lots of viruses that do have a different seasonality. It's not just winter. In schools, you know, it's obviously pretty hard for kids to be able to communicate and learn as much as they want to while wearing masks. And so I think it's going to be one of those things that if we don't have very good immunization rates, I think schools are going to have to consider going back to masks when there's outbreaks of any kind of respiratory disease, even if it's flu or other respiratory viruses. For schools that have pretty good immunization rates, you know, I think that they may have a little bit more latitude to be able to hold off on the masking, even if there's an occasional case here and there. So I think a lot of it really depends on kind of what the community has done as far as getting the kids in that school vaccinated. But I do think we're going to see that masks periodically reemerging and coming out once in a while when you do have the beginnings of widespread disease.
Now, something that parents and kids and teachers, for that matter, don't have direct control over is ventilation in school buildings. I've seen, again, some experts saying this could be a key to helping with not just COVID, but other diseases that spread through the air. Are you hoping that this will be taken seriously?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a lot of older school buildings that, you know, live on radiator heat and don't even have air conditioning. All they've got is windows. And I think people are going to need to start being creative, especially if we get into cold, flu, and COVID season all happening together. You know, we've seen during the early parts of the COVID outbreak in New York City and others that tried to keep their schools open, that even the winter they ended up keeping the windows open to try to keep some circulation going. But I do think that as we move forward and schools are being, you know, gradually rebuilt and retooled, that air circulation is going to be really, really important. And not just in schools. I think in lots of other buildings, I think we're starting to see really more attention to what your air circulation looks like in wherever you work, live, and go to school.
In just our last less than a minute now, what are you watching for, Dr. Conway, as this disease progresses into the fall?
Yeah, I think we're still watching the emergence of these new variants. We're still kind of stuck on BA5 here in the United States in that Omicron strain, but we're tracking a couple of other both new Omicron variants that are starting to pop up in various areas, as well as keeping a close eye out for the newer strains that may actually emerge from new mutations. And then the other piece, obviously, is various companies are working on trying to develop more specific boosters against some of these variants. But I think really the key is going to be just getting people boosted with whatever we've got on hand. I think we always have to remember we can't let perfect be the enemy of good enough.
Dr. Conway, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Always a pleasure.
That's Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist with UW School of Medicine and Public Health, with us today to talk about a new report about the health effects on young people who have had COVID-19 and for some advice on what parents and caregivers need to know about the pandemic ahead of the fall school start. Coming up after the news, a political scientist and legal expert joins the show to talk about what we know and don't know about the FBI search of former President Donald Trump's estate in Florida. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.